You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Back in town, back in the saddle. So nice to be back. A lot been going on. And one of the things that I find most interesting is the possibility, the probability. In fact, I will simply say Ronald Reagan killed 20 first graders in Newtown, Connecticut. Now, I can hear right-wing heads exploding all over the country. In the roughly 2 months since then, Ronald Reagan's also been responsible for more than 1,500 gun deaths in the United States, or at least many of them. Two of those gun deaths happened in Boynton Beach, Florida, over the weekend. 45-year-old Isidro Zavala went to the home of his wife and his two kids on Saturday, armed with a pistol and a semi-automatic Tech 9. It's a semi-pistol. I've actually fired one. It's bigger than a pistol and smaller than a rifle. Last year, Isidro's wife had filed for divorce. So he decided to kill the two kids right in front of her. He told her he wasn't going to kill her. He wanted her to stay alive and suffer watching her own two children killed in front of her. So he then strangled one of his sons to death, then turned the gun on his other son, shot him dead. And then this guy shot himself, leaving his wife to deal with the carnage. Two more dead by way of gun, three killed by Reagan. And then there's what happened in Texas on Monday, where misplaced dog poop led to the deaths of two more Americans by guns. A 75-year-old Dallas man accused his neighbors of dumping dog poop on his patio from the patio up above. And since he had a gun on him, he decided to use it. He walked out to the patio, looked up, saw one of the neighbors standing on the patio above him, shot her dead. He then walked up the stairs into the apartment, shot her boyfriend dead, too. This couple had four kids. Fortunately for the kids, three of them were away from home, and there was an infant in the apartment who was either ignored or missed. But those four kids are not going to have to grow up without parents because of the policies of Ronald Reagan. Right now, Congress is considering gun control legislation. There's no question more background checks will lead to fewer weapons in the hands of criminals and fewer gun deaths, but this isn't about guns. There's also no question that a ban on high-capacity magazines could save lives in future mass shootings, but this isn't about high-capacity magazines. The one thing no one's talking about when it comes to gun violence in America is Ronald Reagan, the guy who brought us 32 years of Reaganomics and thus soaring inequality across our country. Today, wealth inequality in America is worse than it's ever been. We have hit peaks that we haven't seen since 1929 and the 1890s, and we're beyond that now. It's even higher than in any other developed country in the world, nearly the opposite of the way things were when Reagan became president. When he became president, we had a large, strong, healthy, and financially well off. I don't mean like, you know, hey, you know, Thurston Howell III well off, but, you know, people owned their homes, they owned their cars, they could put their kids through school, they had pensions. But it was Reaganomics. Ronald Reagan's tax cuts for the rich, his union busting, his doing away with free college education, his ending the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act, his slashing of the social safety nets that have devastated the working and middle class people of this country. And Americans who once lived the American dream and were not engaging in mass mayhem, there were a hell of a lot of guns around 35 years ago. Not like, you know, we weren't seeing things like we are now. Now, you say, well, you know, now they got all these violent video games. I'm sorry, Japanese teenagers play our violent video games more than our teenagers do. This is not about violent video games. Well, it's about mental illness. Well, no, it's not. Mentally ill people are more likely to be victims of crime than perpetrators. And it, to the extent that you want to say it might be about mental illness, you know, specifically the kid in Newtown, you know, remember, it was Reagan who closed the doors of the facility, the psychiatric facilities, and created an epidemic of homeless, very frequently mentally ill people in the United States. But the Americans who once lived the American dream, who just, you know, had good middle class lives, they're now living in desperation. They're living paycheck to paycheck. They are up to their eyeballs in second mortgages, in credit card debt, in student loan debt, and quite literally, one illness or job loss away from complete financial ruin. Ruin that could literally echo to the very end of their lives and to the rest of their family. Bills pile up, domestic disturbances increase. I mean, there's a correlation between these two. Drug addiction, violence, teen pregnancies, STDs. These are all the natural, predictable, and actually measurable responses to the inequality that Reaganomics has produced. And when you got 300 million guns in America, that's the easily grabbed weapon of choice for when Americans respond to this inequality and its psychological pain with violence. Researchers Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson at the Equality Trust in the UK have done the research on this issue. This is not even debatable. They have found conclusively that the more unequal a society is, the more social ills it has, from violence to drug abuse to mental illness and dozens of other problems. The U.S. is an outlier way up at the top when it comes to gun violence, and also one of the most unequal nations in the world, thanks to 32 years of Reaganomics. Singapore is the only other nation studied that had higher levels of income inequality than the United States, and it doesn't have near as many homicides, which might have something to do with the fact that it's extremely difficult to own a gun in Singapore. In Singapore, you have to get a license, provide justification for why you need the gun, like target shooting or self-defense. If you choose target shooting, you have to store your gun at an approved gun range. If you do get a gun, it will be a small caliber one, as pistols over 32 caliber and all automatic weapons and semi-automatic weapons are outlawed. So this strict gun control might explain Singapore's lack of homicides despite huge inequality rates. It's also a nation that's basically one city. But here in America, we have no such gun control. But we do have wealth inequality that rivals the Roman Empire, again, because of Ronald Reagan. And that's a large part of what's fueling the violence, which is why any gun control legislation, short of virtually banning most guns like Singapore did, is really going to do little to confront this orgy of gun violence in America. Only when we address the real force behind inequality and the violence it produces, Ronald Reagan and his skewed economics, only then can we do something about the thousands who die every year by way of the gun in America. Ronald Reagan and those who've carried his middle class of destroying vision forward, they're the real trigger men behind all these murders. I mean, yes, an assault weapons ban would do something to cut back the firepower associated with American violence. But rolling back the Reagan tax cuts, and thus bringing back the middle class, ending the insane trade policies that we've seen since the Reagan era, ending Reagan's ending of the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act and breaking up some of these big companies, all of that, basically bringing the middle class back to America, restoring free or very, very inexpensive college education. When Reagan came into office, 80% of all college tuition was paid for by the government. Now it's about 20%. If we simply undid the damage of 32 years of Reaganomics, it would do more than any gun control legislation ever.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And so, therefore, I say Ronald Reagan played a role in killing those kids in Newtown. You think I'm wrong? Give me a call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I am literally, as we speak, going to Equality Trust, ITYTR, there we go, .org, .UK. Welcome to the Equality Trust. And just I just want to, you know, share some of the resources that they have, you know, some of the things that they've learned. It's really quite extraordinary, and you can find it all at their website. Child well-being, for example, the UNICEF index of child well-being. It looks at things like living in a home with few books. That's not well-being. No adult is employed. That's not well-being. This is kind of the negative. Health and safety items include immunization rates, death from accidents. Educational well-being included scores on performance tests and the proportion of children going into further education. Peer and family relationships are measured by such things as whether or not children viewed their peers as kind and the number of children living in single-parent and step-parent families. Behaviors and risks included smoking, drinking, how many children had had sex before the age of 15, and then there were subjective ratings, you know, how do you feel about yourself? So the lowest inequality country measured was Sweden. Excuse me, the lowest inequality country measured was Finland. And in Finland, children feel the third best about themselves among the developed world. In other words, low income inequality, kids have not just feel about themselves. I mean, the child well-being, they're more likely to be in a family with books, in a house with books. They're more likely to be in a house where an adult is employed. They're more likely to be in an intact family. They're more likely to be immunized. They're less likely to die. They're more likely to have children around them who score well in education as well as they themselves. They're more likely to have peer and family relationships that are important. Sweden actually is the best in terms of kids of all of them, and it's right up there with Finland in terms of inequality. The most unequal country in the world, this is according to the UNICEF, this UNICEF measurement, and the countries that they looked at were, and here I'll give you the half that are low income inequality. In other words, not so many rich people, not so many poor people, a lot of people in the middle class, okay? That's Finland, Japan, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Netherlands, Belgium, Germany, Austria, Switzerland, Spain, Canada, France, and Ireland. Okay, those are the countries with very low levels of income inequality, large middle class, not so many poor people, not so many rich people. Those countries, without exception, were the ones that all scored above the midpoint, all above the median. In other words, they were all high in terms of child well-being. This is just child well-being, just one index. The countries that scored the worst in child well-being were the United Kingdom, which is experiencing, you know, they've got 35 years of Thatcherism. They've got their own Reaganomics problem, and they've got a conservative government now, austerity. New Zealand, which is the new libertarian paradise. New Zealand has been experimenting with libertarianism for some years. Israel, which, of course, there's a lot of good reasons why kids are not doing so well in Israel. Constant conflict probably being at the top of that list. And the USA. Pretty grim stuff, huh? And this is just the developed countries. I mean, you know, you throw in the less well developed. Now that's just you know, child well being. Look at drug abuse, another index. Just again, looking at inequality, the more equal societies: Japan, Sweden, Finland, Norway, Denmark, Belgium, Germany, Austria. Pretty soon you're going to have this list memorized. Because they're in every case they're the most equal countries. Fewer billionaires, fewer poor people, lots and lots of middle class. Those countries had the lowest levels of drug abuse. They also note, this is the use of opiates, cocaine, cannabis, ecstasy, and amphetamines. They combine them all into one index. They also note among the 50 states of the USA, and they've got these charts and graphs. This is all in their book, The Spirit Level. You can buy the book. or the earlier edition of the book, Why Inequality Matters. But the spirit level is like, you know, 5 years more recent and all the most recent stats. They literally go state by state, all 50 U.S. states. Among the 50 states of the USA, drug addiction and deaths from drug overdoses are related to inequality. Not sort of related, not maybe related, related. Absolute measurable difference. Again, they say we found that the more unequal states had higher death rates. That's drug abuse. Mental health. People say, well, mental health, that has to do with genetics, right? The countries with the percentage of people with any mental illness. The country at the very highest is the United States with over 30%, almost 30% of Americans having a mental illness, an identifiable mental illness. We are also the most unequal of all these countries. Right up there with us is the UK and New Zealand. The countries with the lowest levels of income inequality and the lowest percentage of people with any mental illness. And they say until recently it's hard to actually compare levels of mental illness between countries because nobody had constructed strictly comparable data. But recently the WHO did, and so they're using this. So there's not as many countries in this loop. It's just the WHO. But the countries with the lowest income inequality, Japan, 8% mental illness. Keep in mind, we're 35%. The most equal country in the list. Germany, Spain, Belgium, Netherlands, all below 15% mental illness, less than half of the United States, all dramatically more equal societies.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm telling you, you look at Newtown, you look at the shootings that are happening, you look at this guy who just murdered his kids in front of his wife, it's the Reaganomics. Okay, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Violence. You know, we started out talking about violence. Let me just, you know, very quickly go through some of these numbers, and then I'm going to pick up your phone calls here. In Britain, 35% of people say they're worried about mugging, 33% worried about being attacked, 24% of women worried about rape, 13% worried about being the victim of racial violence, etc. Basically, when you look at the homicide rate per million, the most unequal country in the world, with the exception of Singapore, is us, and we have the highest homicide rate per million, over 60. The next highest is Portugal at about 35. And then you get down to the equal, the less, and which is also a very unequal country. A lot of poor people, a small number of, you know, very small, much smaller middle class. The least violent countries, Japan, Norway, Denmark, Belgium, Sweden, Finland, going to sneeze here, Austria, Germany, Spain, the Netherlands, and Canada. And by the way, they are they have the fewest homicides per million. All of them are below 20. Keep in mind, we're over 60. They also have the highest levels of income equality, lowest levels of income inequality, social mobility. I mean, it goes on and on. I just keep on going through the list. Like I said, you can read it all at equalitytrust.org.uk. And this is not rocket science. Rick in New York City. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm 50 years old. I turned 50 on tax day. And I've watched this country take a spiral down basically because rich people want to stay rich and make a lot of people poor.
Well, stay rich. They wanted to get a hell of a lot richer.
Well, they've thrown the entire country under the bus. Most of my parents were civil servants when I was growing up, and I used to be on their health care, and I used to get some of the best health care available. Now I'm on Medicaid. Basically, I've been turned into a commodity for the hospital corporation. I don't get proper care that I need. Every time I see a different doctor every other day, they don't know what I'm doing or what's about me, and I have to beg for proper medication.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's welcome to the Reagan and post-Reaganomics world. You're absolutely right. Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for sharing your story. John in Naperville, Illinois, listening to WNWF. Hey, John, what's up?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering how long you and I are going to be able to discuss, because I have completely polar opposite viewpoints of yourself.
Well, please tell me a country where inequality is high, like the United States, and all of these social indexes don't suck.
You know what? You caught me off guard. I am on a trip, and you caught me off guard, and I can't give you the stats. I will be able to look it up and get it back. But what I'm saying is, the qualities that you're countries that you're citing, where does that fall into place? You have not used, and I've recorded this program, and I can bring it back to you. You've never used the words responsibility, accountability, individual progress, nothing else. You're talking about none of these people would want to go live in those countries. And if it's just about children and inequality, let me tell you, Tom, there's a book out there, and you should read it, okay? It's called Reduced Ability. It's about the dumbing down of society.
Yeah. Respectfully, John, if you think that nobody would ever want to live in any of those countries, you have not visited them. I lived in Europe for a year.
I'm sorry. I lived in Europe for 3 years.
Okay. So I don't understand how you can say somebody would not want to live in Austria or the Netherlands or Germany or France or in particular Norway, Finland, Sweden.
I'm telling you, the people that are being affected by the stats of which you're citing, those people would not want, and I would bet my yes. You and I,
those are the people who are doing really well. Those are the people who have the lowest levels of violence, the lowest levels of sexually transmitted disease, the lowest levels of teenage pregnancy, the highest educational outcomes, and those are the countries that have the lowest income equality, or wealth equality, inequality.
Would you like to put out the real stats for your listeners? Reaganomics also benefited a huge amount of our culture and a huge amount. I benefited. My parents benefited. I'm one of five. We all benefited from it, but I can tell you.
Are you talking about his doubling of the taxes on working people or his cutting by three quarters the taxes on billionaires? Which of those was that?
The previous.
Okay, so by doubling the Social Security tax, by doubling the tax that people make back in Reagan's day who made up to $40,000 a year, now it's up to $113,000. That helped us?
It also made you're failing to lose an awful lot. There's an awful lot of other points of his.
Okay, by his running up, by his tripling the national debt, first president in the history of the United States to do that, that helped us?
Are you ludicrous?
When Reagan came into office, the national debt was a little over $800 billion. When he left, it was over $3 trillion. Most of that, at least a trillion of that, went to the military-industrial complex for the Star Wars program. He basically was spending money hand over fist as fast as he could. He borrowed more money than every president from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined. He was the first president to do any such thing. He borrowed more money in real terms than we spent on World War II.
You know what? You're going to remember me saying this. I'm agreeing with you 100%. But when you do put money into military, when you do put money into compounds and things like you're stating, you got to realize that's money that's going to come back to you.
No.
Let me just say this right here, and then we're done, Tom.
I will let you say that, John. I'll let you say all you want afterwards, but let me just make this point. If you take, as Franklin Roosevelt did, let's compare Republicans to Republicans, as if you do like Dwight Eisenhower did and borrow a couple hundred billion dollars and build roads and bridges and highways and hospitals and schools, those things produce revenue for the country for the next 2, 3, 4 generations. If, on the other hand, you do as Reagan did and you borrow trillions of dollars, he borrowed over $2 trillion, borrow trillions of dollars and use it to build weapons of war that are taken to other nations and dropped on them and then evaporate, or when they're obsolete, they're turned into scrap, that produces no ongoing wealth for the country. It produces short-term jobs, absolutely. There is a short-term stimulus, but it's a bubble stimulus, which is why Reagan had the worst recession at that point in the history of the United States since the Great Depression. Back to you.
Okay. I can put it in much simpler terms for me and for you. And remember me and your listening audience, remember me saying this. Just give me an answer on which gentleman you would give the money to. I just developed a scenario, and I'll read it to you, and it's pretty quick, okay? You and I are buddies. We go to Starbucks, and we get coffee. You've got $50,000 in your pocket. I've got $50,000 in my pocket. We both borrowed it. We borrowed that money, and we have to return that money for failure to go to jail. We have to return that money in 1 year. We have to return that money in a year. We borrowed that money from a bank or a lending institution or friend or whatever, but we walked out of that Starbucks with $50,000 in each of our pockets. You have to make a decision now. You turn left out of Starbucks, there is a billionaire standing there. You got to give him the $50,000, or you turn right out of Starbucks, and there's a homeless guy there with no health insurance or nothing, and you've got to give him the $50,000. And in a year, you come back, and you walk up to that gentleman and say, can I have my $50,000 back? Who do you want to get? If your life depended on it, Tom, who would you give your money to that was borrowed and you have to return it? Would you give it to the wealthy man? No. I don't want to. It's a very simple question.
Yeah, let me answer.
Who would you give it to?
I would give it to the homeless guy, and here's why, if you'll listen. First of all, your question assumes that a country has the same goal as an individual, and that's not the case. If you read the Constitution of the United States, it starts out with we the people. It lists six reasons why we created the United States. And among them is to promote the general welfare, to promote domestic tranquility, things like that. So if you gave that $50,000 to the homeless guy, he's going to spend 100% of it. When he spends that money, he goes into stores and spends that money, those stores will have to buy products. When they go out to the wholesalers and say, we need to buy, plus they're going to pay salaries to their workers. When they buy products, the factories are going to say, hey, we've got to make some stuff. And so they're going to hire some people. When they start, those factories are going to need raw materials. And so they're going to contact their suppliers and they're going to hire people. So that $50,000 is going to become in the economy. If you're looking at this as a nation, that $50,000 is probably going to, back before free trade, it would have become about $240,000. The force multiplier before NAFTA and GATT was around 4.3, 430%. Right now, because of NAFTA and GATT, it's around 1.3. So that $50,000 will become about $65,000 or $70,000 in the economy to the benefit of society. So if instead of being a human being, you're Uncle Sam, you give it to the homeless guy. On the other hand, if you give it to the billionaire, he will put it in a Swiss bank account, and you'll never see another penny of it.
But you got to get it back. In other words, he'll get. I'll tell you what, Tom, your listener.
That's my point. Your metaphor, John, is flawed in that you're assuming that the goal of an individual is the same as the goal of a nation. That the work of an individual is the same as the work of a nation. When Dwight Eisenhower came into office, Republican Dwight Eisenhower came into office, our debt to GDP ratio was worse than it is now. It was 127%. We owed 127% of the entire GDP of the United States. And he got us out of that, not by cutting a penny from spending, but by borrowing and spending more money, that's by basically giving it to the homeless guy, by putting people to work building roads and bridges and hospitals and schools.
I'll tell you what. How about this, Tom?
And we paid off the debt.
Am I still on?
Yeah.
Okay, Tom. You got a great show here. I'll give you my information. I'll give your show my information. I'll keep in touch with you. I will put up that amount of money. I will meet you. I will fly. I will meet you. And we can prove to your listeners.
John, your premise is flawed. This isn't about how an individual should invest $50,000. This is how a nation should conduct itself. And that's the problem with Reaganomics, is it's based on this libertarian notion that we're a me society and that it's all about the individual. That's infantilism. That's what the advertising industry does, is it reduces us to children. I, me, me, me. I want, I want, I want. In fact, as adults, we should be asking ourselves what's best for all of us. Read Matthew 25.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I think that, for at least a couple thousand years, we've kind of had this figured out. Give it to the least among us. Fair and only, slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Nate in Denver, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for your show. And Reagan, now I'm 45, so I miss some of Reagan. I mean, as a intelligent person, but Reagan made greed okay.
Yeah,
I mean, this country before Reagan, it looked out for each other, right?
Mm-hmm. By and large, yeah.
$3 million or whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
and the rest had to go back into the system. You put it back into your company. You gave your employees better benefits, right?
Yep.
Reagan made greed okay. It's okay now for an individual to make $1 billion in income.
Or $2 billion a year. There's 11 guys on Wall Street who are making more than $2 billion a year each.
That's right. And I mean, that's $1,000 million homes. You can't even go to three of them every day of the year and see them all.
I know, and that's 1 year's income.
Too much money.
I mean, $1 billion is $1,000 million. That means every day of the year you're making $3 million. Can you imagine every day $3 million in the checking account? Well, there's that 20% capital gains tax off the top, but you don't have to pay Social Security tax on it because hey, that's been capped out at $113,000. So
it's just unfair and it's not right and no one is worth $1 billion of income.
Yeah,
not in a year.
I think frankly no one's worth $1 billion. Period, and that's why we've got this website nobillionaires.com. And I'm suggesting that we should actually have a wealth tax that says you can have $1 billion, but your billion and first, that's going back to society. And as you pointed out, back in the day, back before Reagan, after you made a couple $1 million a year, the tax rate hit 91% or 74% was the top rate as Reagan came in. But it was 91% up until the Johnson administration. And people said, $3 million a year, that's fine. It wasn't that they stopped working. It was that they worked for a $3 million a year paycheck and they put the rest of it back into the company or they paid their employees decent wages. You're absolutely right, Nate.
No one says it has to be $3 million. I mean, come up with a number.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a fair
any number. Today you could make the number $100 million, $50 million, $5 million, whatever. There's got to be there's at some point we need to have a conversation about how much is enough and versus how much damage is being done to society by these guys who are just basically taking it all. Nate, thanks a lot for the call. John in Naperville, Illinois, listening to WCPT, who I suspect the previous John was also listening to. I think he gave me the call letters of the right-wing station in Chicago instead.
Hello.
Which I said on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm disagreeing with the other John in Naperville.
Mm.
Basically, I'm really glad you have this topic about how income inequality harms society. And what first made me aware of this, in school they talk about the French Revolution and Marie Antoinette and let them eat cake, and they kind of imply that it's not good when the wealth of everybody's in the hands of a few. But
right. There's
a talk on TED by Richard Wilkinson that's very good.
He's the guy whose statistics I was just quoting.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask if it's from that because I've had a lot of my right-wing friends watch this video. And because he's actually, I think, English, and he starts out talking about income inequality in England, it doesn't look like he has a U.S. agenda.
Right.
But then he applies the same techniques to even states.
State by state in the United States. Same
right. It's
result.
A very powerful video.
Yeah. I'll have to check that out. It doesn't surprise me at all because Richard Wilkinson, he's been on this program a couple of times. He and Kate Pickett, who put together this book and did a lot of this research, absolutely brilliant guy and spot on. John, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to WCPT. Janet, listening to WRL in New York City. Hey, Janet.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Hello from New York. Tom, I wanted to comment on that research, too. There's a very another interesting body of research done by a professor, Dan Ariely, A-R-I-E-L-Y, for anyone who wants to check it out. He's a behavioral economist at Duke University.
Hmm.
And he and his partner did a study. They asked, 1,000 Americans what kind of society they'd like to live in. And they gave them three alternatives. One was a society more unequal than ours. One was kind of like ours, and one was like Sweden.
Only they didn't tell them that there was countries. They just described the quality. Yeah,
they didn't mention names. They just described the country. And then they said, so the results were amazing. The results were 92% of all respondents, that includes conservatives and liberals, said they wanted to live in Sweden, in a Sweden-like country.
Right.
And the difference between conservatives and liberals was, I think, 1%. It was like 93 mm-hmm. versus 92. And the same thing with rich versus poor. Rich people said by about 92%, and poor people said 93%. So if everybody wants to live in a country like Sweden, how come we don't have one?
Well, yeah, it's a good question, and I think you can thank the Supreme Court for that by saying corporations are people and money is speech, and therefore, that and the Reagan Revolution have brought about this disaster. Janet, thank you for the call. And I would add, if John is still listening, this is worth tracking down. This German businessman, a multimillionaire German businessman, being interviewed on Bloomberg about a year ago, year and a half ago, thereabouts. And I just, you know, caught this on TV. I mean, it was just it was like flying by as I was channel surfing. It was on Bloomberg News, the show that they do out of Hong Kong, as I recall. And so this German businessman is being interviewed by this very conservative, politically conservative, financially conservative guy. And they're talking about the, you know, macroeconomics. And then the guy says, how much do you pay in taxes in Germany of your income? And the guy says, probably around 55-60%. And the guy goes, oh, that's terrible. That's huge. And the guy says, yeah, I don't mind. And then they talk about something else. And then the guy comes back to it and he says, tell me again how much, you know, how much your income goes to taxes? And he goes, 55-60%. Maybe a little more than that, actually, when you consider local taxes. Might even be 70%. And the guy says, I can't believe this. How can you put up with that? And there's a pause for a moment where the German's looking at him, kind of like scratching his head, going, what? You know, what's wrong with this guy? And finally, the German says, I don't want to be a rich man in a poor country. I'd much rather be a rich man in a rich country. And if paying 65 or 70% of my income in taxes means doing that, I'm willing to do that. Now, of course, for the people in Germany who are making the equivalent of poverty wages in the United States, their taxes are very low, just like in the United States. But in Germany, they got it. They got it figured out.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we you know, I spent the last hour talking about inequality in the United States and how the policies, by and large, of the Reagan administration, not exclusively. I'll tell you, Jimmy Carter started drinking that deregulation Kool-Aid a couple of years, during the last 2 years of his administration. And Bill Clinton drank some of it with NAFTA and GATT, but by and large, this was the Reagan administration. What the consequence of that has been to the United States. Dave Tristani has a somewhat different perspective on this. He's an ordained pastor, former professional wrestler, and author of From the Ring to the Pulpit. Dave, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. God can solve the world's problems, you say. Tell me how.
Well, I believe that if we follow the principles and precepts that God has set before us, then
you mean in the Quran or the Upanishads?
I'm talking in the Bible.
Oh, okay, but what about what's in the Upanishads or the Quran or the writings of Buddha?
Okay. I am a Christian faith, and I believe that the Christian Bible is the one true source of God's word.
What do you do about those people who, you know, I mean, those other faiths pretty much teach the same thing in terms of, you know, the kind of Matthew 25 or Matthew 7, you know, the Sermon on the Mount and separating the sheep from the goats, that kind of stuff. You know, the core teachings are not all that different. What about those people? Can't they help the world too? Can't those?
Well, I'm not saying they can't help the world.
Okay.
That's, you know, you can be ethical, you can be good, and not be Christian.
How about being agnostic or atheist?
You can be ethical, you can be good.
Yeah,
okay. Be Christian, okay? You can do that.
Then why do we need you know, a God up in the sky to? Please don't think I'm being too cynical. I identify myself as a Christian, but you know, why do we need this you know, remote deity directing things for us?
Well, first off, I don't believe he's in the sky, okay? I believe that he resides within each person who has accepted his son, Jesus Christ, as Lord and Savior. So he resides within us in the form of the Holy Spirit, and he helps lead and guide us. And the reason I think that we need him is that he gives us that guidance. We have something to look back on to make our ethical decisions on, to decide what is ethical and what isn't. And, you know, as opposed to just working off of logic and reason.
When I look at how things work in the world, I mean, just, you know, kind of looking around, it seems like most of the people in prison are men. Most of the violent crimes are committed by men. Most of the unethical, you know, the Wall Street criminal, you know, white collar criminals, blue collar criminals, you name it, they're men. The people who are more nurturing and more reasonable, for lack of a better word, seem to be women, even in political positions. Why would we be taking advice from a deity that has a penis instead of a deity that has a vagina?
Well, first off, you're saying that God is human like us.
Well, you're saying him, so I'm wondering why.
Well, because, again, going back to Scripture, we believe that God is Father God, not Mother God. Okay, and that it is Jesus Christ, His only begotten Son.
Well, you know, there was that period from the 10th to the 12th century in Europe when Mary was actually worshipped more frequently than Jesus. The Crusades and the post-Crusades period put pretty much an end to that, but you can still find a lot of remnants of it if you travel around the old European, particularly in France, in southwestern France, or southeastern France, rather. Why not?
It doesn't mean it's right.
But what if we've been wrong all this time?
It's a spiritual being, and we are made in His image, both male and female.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what Scripture tells us.
Okay.
So, you know, it's a concept that's very hard to explain, very hard to understand, because and I use the word He, but God is a spiritual being, and again, we are made in His image, both male and female. And
I'm assuming, Dave Tristani, that
we can relate to that.
That when things happen, like, you know, Hurricane Sandy, or the horrible shooting in Newtown, or whatever, that you're not one of those folks who would say, as so often, I mean, you know, you see a natural disaster and some idiot, from a TV news station sticks a microphone in one of the survivors' faces and they say, oh, God saved me and my trailer, but nobody ever asks, well, does that mean God killed the people in the trailer next to you and, you know, that got blown 300 yards down the road? That you're not among those folks who thinks that those decisions, who lives and who dies, are being made by God, or do you?
Well, I believe that God is in control of everything that happens on Earth. Now, He doesn't sit there and decide should this house be blown over, should that house be blown over, should you paint your house pink or blue, or should you, you know, what color shirt you should wear. That.
But He does decide who you should have sex with.
He tells us in the Bible that man is to be with woman.
And that you shouldn't eat shellfish.
In the Old Testament, He did say that, yes.
Yeah, he's pretty emphatic about that. And you shouldn't wear clothes made out of two kinds of fabric. I mean, it's in the Old Testament where he talks about man and woman, that men shouldn't be having sex with other men. That's
right.
Nowhere to be found in the New Testament, to the best of my knowledge. So if we're going to look to the Old Testament for wisdom, should we start stoning to death people who are eating shellfish?
No, of course not.
Should we at least go picket Red Lobster?
No, not at all. If you like fish, eat it.
But that's not fish. That's shellfish. Those are large, giant insects.
If you like it, eat it. You know. Again, we have to look at the Old Testament and what was going on at that time. And God was taking a people and building a nation, and He had to teach them the basics, and that's why all the rules and the laws and so on. And you know, He taught them to dig latrines or trenches outside the camp.
Sure, and don't eat pigs because they have trichomiasis. I understand the kind of sociological logic of many of the Levitical laws. Not all of them, but many of them. But I still don't get, and I'm all in favor of people being religious, and even more in favor of people being spiritual. You know, having not just showing up Sunday and dropping $10 in the plate, but of actually having some sort of a personal connection with whatever it is that they feel is beyond them, whether it's looking through a telescope and you know, or whether it's getting on their hands and knees and praying to Jesus. I'm all in favor of all of that. And in fact, I think that it lightens and enlightens the world. But I don't see how that's going to help our having 40 million uninsured people in the United States, which causes 40,000 people a year to die unnecessarily?
Well, as human beings, we have free will to choose. Now, we can choose to take care of one another. We can choose to slaughter one another. We can choose whatever we want.
We've been choosing more of the slaughtering than the taking care of, though.
I agree. We've had so many disasters, let's say. Yeah. And I'm not talking natural disasters, but just where people make the wrong choice and choose to hurt rather than choose to love.
Yeah.
And God does allow that. Okay, He allows that. Because if He takes away that choice to whether to hurt someone or to shower them with love, if He says you must love, you can't hurt anyone, then what ends up happening is He has to take away all of your free will.
Yeah.
And that's not the God that we serve. The God that we serve wants us to have free will so that we can choose to love Him or not to love Him.
Okay, Dave, I'm going to leave you. We've got to go, but I want to leave you right there with that as the last word. I think it's beautiful. Dave Tristani, ordained pastor, former professional wrestler, author of From the Ring to the Pulpit, God Can Solve the World's Problems. Hang on just a second, Dave.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Guy always comes in there and steps on me. Dave Tristani, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Good talking to you, sir. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and 20 minutes past the hour. Boy, a lot of interesting stuff going on here today, and you know who's doing what? Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, you had some thoughts on that $50,000 bet the guy was trying to make with me the last hour?
Yeah, I was just wondering, was that one of Mitt Romney's sons? Maybe Tag or
There you go. Tag just announced that he's not actually going to run for something, Congress or governorship or something. I don't think anybody knew he was or even thought he was. It was just trying to get it in the press. But and interesting that he was named after was it Dabney Taggart or whatever who was the one of the heroes or heroines of Atlas Shrugged of all bizarre things. Paul, thanks for the call. Who knows? Remarkable. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
The debate that you were having with Dave Tristani, I guess is his name.
Tristani, yeah.
Tristani, yeah. Comes under the heading of theodicy.
Mm-hmm.
Theodicy is the idea of why do we suffer?
Mm-hmm.
Why do we suffer?
It's what Job struggled with.
Yeah, fine. And what Dave was arguing, actually, there are about a half a dozen different points in the Bible, or different positions in the Bible as why we suffer.
Well, in the case of Job, God actually was gambling with Satan and said, I'll make you a bet. I'll bet I can, or Satan said, I'll make you a bet. I'll bet I can get this guy to turn on you. And God said, I'll bet he won't. And then God started smiting him with everything from boils to killing his children. I mean,
There are a half a dozen positions. He was taking the Isaiah position, which is Isaiah and Amos, who said, the reason we suffer is because we sin.
Right.
And God has to leave us that choice. But by the way, what he told Job after, Job in the poetic dialogues, after those were over, chapter 39, Job asked, why? Why are you making me suffer? And what does God tell Job? It's not for you to know.
Yeah.
It's none of your business.
Yeah.
That's
Job. Could that be that, if you play a really nasty practical joke on somebody, you really don't want to own up to it?
Well, actually, Satan in that context back in the Septuagint doesn't mean the devil. It means the adversary, the so-called devil's advocate. There's a very good book, let me point it out, by Professor Bart D. Ehrman at the University of North Carolina, the Religious Studies Department, called God's Problem.
Mm-hmm.
Why we suffer.
Yeah.
How the Bible fails to answer this question.
Yeah.
And it points out, in the New Testament, there are, again, Paul and the other writers of the New Testament, which are not who they say they are.
Many of them.
Have their ideas as to what they're suffering in redemption. That's another point of view.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent point, Paul. And it's stuff that I love to talk about, but I also don't want to turn this into the old time Bible hour. And so thank you for the call. We'll continue the conversation as time goes on. Nick in Arcata, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Nick.
Tom, you're such a wonderful guy. I want to talk about the $50,000 bet guy, okay?
Okay.
It was interesting because you gave him illustration after illustration, fact after fact, as to why we are better off as a me society than an I society. And he
as a we society.
Couldn't understand it.
Right. Right.
Why?
I am guessing that he was somebody who was probably less than 10 or 15 years old when Ronald Reagan became president, and so does not have the actual experiential recollection of when America was a more egalitarian nation. I mean, we were among the OECD nations pretty much one of the most equal. In fact, we were the most socially mobile before Reagan's presidency, and we are now the least socially mobile of all the OECD nations, the richest nations in the world. And I'm just guessing, you know, I'm a little older than that, and I remember it. I remember it really, really well. I mean, I was out there, you know, making a living and raising kids in the 70s, and I'm guessing that he probably hadn't been born. I'm just guessing. I don't know. I don't know why anybody else, you know, what I find is it's, you know, when I talk about this to audiences, when I'm talking to people who are, you know, old enough to remember what life was like before Reagan, everybody's head is nodding up and down, and everybody gets it instantly. You don't even have to explain this stuff to them. On the other hand, when I'm talking to audiences of 20-somethings, 30-somethings, 40-somethings, this memory has been lost. And, you know, the closest that they can get to it is maybe, you know, Andy of Mayberry and old reruns of Beaver Cleaver. And they just don't think that that's real, you know, that the world was like that. Am I making sense, Nick?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. But the thing is, you gave him facts. You gave him times.
Well, he promised that he would call back with facts. So, you know, I'm here
right.
5 days a week, you know, pretty much 52 weeks a year, and at least 51.
Maybe we'll hear more.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Nick, thanks a lot for the call. Diana in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Diana.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to respond to the hypothetical scenario the guy proposed about the Starbucks
portion. Mm-hmm.
I would give the money to the homeless person. I think it's a flawed experiment, the way that he presented it.
Of course.
Because you have to consider, you know, the environmental variables, which my first thought would be you're talking about a human being. You know, you're talking about a human being, and you're going to be looking into the eyes of two other human beings and unable to see the grief, the despair, the need, the, you know, sickness. You'd have to totally be able to disregard that as a human being.
Right.
Also, you're going to assume that the billionaire is also going to disregard it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give them credit. They might have empathy also, you know, in that given
They might,
scenario.
But the odds are if they did that, well, they may still be a billionaire. They may be, you know, some very wealthy people do an awful lot of good with their wealth.
The odds are if you gave them the money, it would be in the Cayman Islands, so you wouldn't get it back anyhow.
Yeah. Well, that was my point to him is, you know, you give it to the billionaire. Well, you know, if your goal is to get it back, you know, with interest or as a price, it's interesting because it's basically this proverb. This is a conundrum that Jesus confronted, or a story that Jesus told his disciples, and, you know, of the farmer, I guess it wasn't his sons, and you know, the one, was it his sons or his servants? It was his servants. And you know, he kind of punished the guy who didn't do something with the money. But I think that there's a deeper story to it than that. Diana, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I got to share with you, too, a blog posting over at the TomHartman.com website by Blue Horse about right to work for less legislation. It's going to blow your mind. Helping you with the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Yes, Eric Cantor. The Dreamers should get a pathway to citizenship. You know, the Republican Party is trying to rebrand itself right now. The only problem is their rhetoric is completely different from their policies. They've decided that if they talk a good line, maybe people will believe them. They tried that during the election. Remember that? They kept going, Obama took $700 billion out of Medicare. Actually, he didn't. I mean, it was a lie. And it got repeated by Mitt Romney, and it was repeated by everybody. And people figured out it was a lie. Even people on Medicare figured out it was a lie because, hey, you know, their money was still there. But You know, the Republicans are going to try it again. What's the old definition of insanity? You know, doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting a different result? Amazing. Amazing. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John. What's up?
Yeah. Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to, talk a little bit more about religion and the religious right. And I think that, in my opinion, my humble opinion, they really want to change, you know, this country from a secular state to a religious state that is specifically their religion.
Well, and in fact, they want to claim that it always has been.
They want to eliminate free will because they don't want really people to make a free choice. They want to, you know, basically take their agenda and they want to capture power. They're after power, and I don't think it's crazy to think this. I've seen so many different documentaries that are on free speech TV, and recently the revisionist that was done by Independent Lens. And, you know, I think that my brand of Christianity just would not do very well under them. I think that, who knows, maybe I'd be martyred or something.
Yeah.
Because,
well, it's happened, and I'm, you know, it's...
I don't know how they, inject themselves onto other people. They're so much into eliminating free will, it's not funny. And, I have respect for people of other religions, and if they want to join my religion, I hope that they join it by my example of what I do, how I conduct myself, who I am as a person, not by force.
And I think that's the essential teaching of the Christianity that I was raised in any case, and frankly, most of the other religions that I've hung out with, bounced off of, or studied. So, John, good point. Thanks a lot for the call. Vince in Howell, New Jersey. Hey, Vince.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I normally listen to the right radios and all this other business, and then I heard about your number one show, and it's very good. So I decided to listen to you today, and I'm glad I was able to get in. I'm a physician, and some of the things that I'm hearing your audience say, and you, quite frankly, I think it could go both sides, whether it be the Republicans or the Democrats. For example, the rhetoric behind Obama saying that you will be able to keep your position is completely and utterly untrue. And I don't understand how that's not being picked up, but it's just not true with the way that the healthcare law is. And in fact, when you talk about we nation means that we could have physicians practice without being scared of being sued at the rate that we are. That's not a we nation, but the healthcare law did nothing to address that.
Well, first of all, let me say, Vince, that if there are bad doctors out there, I would hope that they could get weeded out, and lawsuits are probably one of the most efficient ways to do it. Secondly, I've spoken with, we have health insurance for all of our full-time employees, which is pretty much all of our employees, we're not going to change it. I mean, and people can have their same doctors. I mean, what you're saying is just not a fact.
Well, okay, so let me put it to you this way. I believe that it would have been more effective or at least more accurate if Obama said, if you have this certain type of insurance, some of you, maybe not all of you, will be able to keep your...
Vince, you're representing yourself as an expert on Obamacare, and whether you're a physician or not, I would submit that you're operating under a lot of misperceptions, and both of us are operating under a lack of perceptions because many of the rules that are under which this system is going to operate have not even been written or put into law. And so there's a certain we'll see factor here that may swing more in the direction of your theology here, and or maybe more in the direction of mine, but I, it's still evolving, as you well know.
Yeah, to your point, and I say this to my colleagues that we were headed this direction before the law, okay?
Nixon tried to move us in this direction in 72. You know, it was Nixon proposed what essentially is Obamacare in 72, and Teddy Kennedy blew it up because it had to be perfect or nothing at all. I see this as a gradual and evolutionary process that hopefully will work to the benefit of society as well as physicians as well. But I think the most important thing is the public health aspect of this. As contagious diseases are becoming more and more virulent, and we now have, you know, all this research on the H5N1 flu and whatnot, and you've got MRSA and everything else out there. TB is making a comeback. Two of the hotspot TB cities in the world, out of maybe 80 or 90 in the world, but two of them are New York and Los Angeles. We really need to make sure that everybody in this country is getting health care, you know, whether they want to pay for it or not. They need to be getting it, just so that you and I can know that the guy sitting next to us on the airplane or on the bus or on the park bench who's coughing isn't blowing some drug-resistant strain of TB in our face.
Right. And just one more point. Sure. As you, I got to tell you, I really like your show. I'm going to start listening to you. And one last point I want to make as a physician in terms of, because you're probably going to get this a lot throughout the years, that I think that a lot of physicians like myself take the position that we're not looking to get paid any more than we are. We're not, because we know that we'll bankrupt the country. However, we have to do something about our expenses, have malpractice insurance,
sure,
all these things like that, to allow us the ability to take on more patients, to give them more time, to focus on their treatment. Otherwise, if what's being happening now, which is being ignored, is our malpractice insurance premiums, which are $10,000 to $15,000 a month, which are our expenses and everything like that, makes it harder and harder for us to practice.
Yeah, I can't speak to that. I'm not a doc, and I don't know. Although one of my kids is headed in that direction right now. Just curiously, and feel free to tell me it's none of my business. You don't want to share it, but I'm wondering, you know, what kind of doc are you, and how much do you make a year?
I'm a heart surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
I net around 550. I'm not an economist. I can't remember what net and gross is, but
yeah.
I make around $550,000 a year, but after expenses, I make about $125,000.
No. You're a heart surgeon, and you're taking home $125,000?
Yes. I have my own private practice.
Uh-huh.
I have three employees,
right,
that make $60,000 a year.
Yeah.
All right? I have... my practice insurance was about $125,000.
Yeah, Vince, I think you're underpaid. I mean, you know, when you look at how long it takes to become a heart surgeon,
right,
the fact that a banker in New York City is making in an hour what you make in a year is
right.
Crazy. That's absolutely crazy.
$1,200 a month in student loans.
Yeah.
So you put all that together.
Yeah. I got it. And this is why. You know, we need a really comprehensive health reform system, you know, here in the United States. And we need it done in a way that respects everybody from literally the homeless person who's uninsured, who is a public health risk to themselves and to others, to the heart surgeons. And we need to do it in a way that, you know, respects the level of work that's put in. And I think that the fact that this country has the 28th to the 37th lowest health outcomes, depending on which of the indexes you're looking at, among the OECD nations, among the 34 richest nations in the world, and we on average pay more than twice per person per capita for our health care, speaks, and then, you know, somebody like you calls up with this situation, speaks to a real problem. And I don't have an instant and easy solution for it. But I do, you know, look around the world and say, you know, Switzerland, for example, is not a government-administered program. It's entirely private corporations, but they are required by law to be not-for-profit. And therefore, Switzerland is able to, and you are required to have health insurance. And Switzerland is able, therefore, to provide health insurance and have a higher standard of living for about half the cost of what we do. You know, other countries, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, they have something closer to a single payer system. The UK has a socialist system where the government actually, you know, docs are actually employees of the government. The hospitals are owned by the government. Every one of those seems to work better than ours. I mean, we have that in the VA. The VA is socialized medicine. We have that with Medicare, which is a single payer system. We know what these systems can do and how they can work and what their weaknesses are. And it seems like we ought to be able to come up with something that makes sense, where somebody like you is making a little more, and somebody like Stephen J. Hemsley, who is the CEO of United Healthcare, who has taken over $1 billion in compensation, and the guy before him, who is the CEO of United Healthcare, Dollar Bill McGuire, took $1.8 billion in compensation. That is totally nuts. And these guys, you know, you're operating in somebody's heart. These guys never even looked at somebody's tonsils, and they're
right.
making
and
a billion.
You're speaking about, you know, Switzerland, all these other things. I don't think that your listeners may even understand that the big difference, however, is those doctors that trained out there probably paid very little or if nothing for medical school.
You're absolutely right. There is virtually no school debt in any European country. You're absolutely right. And that's why I'm a big fan of free higher education in the United States. I think it's the best investment in the most important infrastructure, our intellectual infrastructure that we can make. Vince, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more. Oh, I was going to share this the Right to Work for Less legislation thing with you that Blue Horse wrote. I'll do that after the break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And now the White House press secretary hounded by reporters on drones, says Huffington Post. That's an interesting topic. We'll pick that up in the next hour. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, I'm going to have to get to this Right to Work legislation in the next hour because the Talk Radio News Service, Victoria Jones, is on the line. I want to know what's going on in the world right at this moment here at 4:50 Eastern Time on this beautiful Tuesday. Our Talk Radio News Service, by the way, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of the goat and the person that you helped. Victoria Jones. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up in the world?
The Pentagon has decided to extend some benefits to the spouses of gay and lesbian personnel and is expected to announce that decision this week.
That is remarkable. You know, it was the Pentagon. I mean, it was by executive order. I believe it was Truman. The Pentagon was the first to integrate the military. Or the military was the first, you know, to be fully integrated. It's like the military has, which is, by the way, a socialist institution. They provide for your housing, your clothing, your food, your transportation, everything, your education. The military has, it seems, so often been at the forefront of social change in the United States.
It's very interesting. It really is very interesting. And this will sort of cap Defense Secretary Leon Panetta's short time. He's only been there 18 months, and he will have seen the ending of the ban on openly gay service members and the decision to allow women to serve in combat, and now this. Now, they can't end the ban on all benefits, of course, because the Defense of Marriage Act is still in effect. The case before the Supreme Court comes up at the end of March. Mm. So that is likely to be announced towards the end of this week.
Right. And that being the Pentagon decision, the Supreme Court decision, even though it's heard at the end of March, is probably going to be announced, what, in July, August, September?
June, they're expecting.
June.
June, yes.
Okay. Great.
Also today, President Obama came out into the White House briefing room and called on Congress to quickly pass a package of limited spending cuts and tax changes. Before the sequester, the automatic cuts come into effect on March the 1st, saying they need to do this. They would delay the economically damaging effects of the sequester for a few more months until Congress finds a way to replace these cuts with a smarter solution. He made the argument that, look, we can't cut our way to prosperity, but he's saying that we are at a risk here if we don't do something right now of really setting ourselves back if we allow these cuts to come into place. And he also made the point that the various offers that he had put forward during the fiscal cliff negotiations and discussions with Speaker John Boehner and others are still very much on the table. And he said, I just want to repeat, and he said it again. And he talked about reforms to Medicare and other entitlements and health care proposals that he'd made, and he also talked about tax reforms. He talked about modest reforms in social insurance programs have to go hand in hand with a process of tax reform, and he took no questions.
Yeah, but hasn't John Boehner already basically said that this is a, in fact, he's making fun of it?
Yes, John Boehner did a pre-buttal, actually, and talked about the president's sequester, which is what the House Republicans and all Republicans are now referring to it as, failing to acknowledge that actually more Republicans voted for the sequester than Democrats did
in
Congress.
Right. Do you know whose idea it was originally?
Well, Bob Woodward says that it was the president's idea.
Mm-hmm.
that it was the president's idea, but Republicans embraced it joyously,
yeah.
And many Democrats in Congress were quite wary of it.
Yeah, right, and rightfully so. Although, you know, the Republicans were doing their hostage-taking routine, so what do you do?
I don't know.
What else is up?
Very quickly, Senator Lindsey Graham is calling on President Barack Obama to withdraw Chuck Hagel as his candidate to be Secretary of Defense, saying that his performance at his hearing was less than confidence-inspiring. He's not threatening a filibuster. So far, nobody has. Everybody's walking around with bated breath, waiting to see if anybody does.
Nobody will. This is all theater.
At the moment, it seems to be all theater.
I mean, filibustering a cabinet nominee is, I mean, that's the sort of thing you do for somebody like Robert Bork. I mean, somebody who has just an obvious history of insane positions.
Yes.
I don't know how to say it beyond that.
And Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron said today, same-sex marriage is an important step forward and will make our society stronger. Conservative Tory MP David Cameron said, I am an important, strong believer in marriage. It helps people commit to each other, and I think it is right that gay people should be able to get married, too. That is, about equality.
Now,
and the Commons voted in favor of the marriage bill by 400-175 today.
So it goes to the House of Lords?
Goes to the House of Lords.
Now, you called David Cameron the MP. That's Member of Parliament. Isn't he the PM, the Prime Minister?
He's both. You have to be an MP in order to be the PM.
Oh, that's interesting. And so the title that they use is the MP.
Right. Well, they call him the PM because it means Prime Minister, but he is a Member of Parliament for his particular district, and then they choose him to be the Prime Minister.
So it's sort of like Nancy Pelosi being there, or John Boehner in this case, being the Speaker of the House,
exactly.
Is also the Prime Minister.
Exactly.
I did not know that. And forgive my ignorance of the country of your birth. I realize you're an American now, but I somehow was operating under the understanding that the Prime Minister was separately appointed or elected. So that means that Nick Clegg, who's the sort of mini-me for Mr. Cameron, only of the left persuasion, that he's also a PM as well as a sort of MP.
He's also an MP.
Yeah, or an MP, I mean, rather.
He's also an MP, that's right.
Member of Parliament.
So that David Cameron could lose his job as Prime Minister, but still keep his very safe Conservative seat in his own district.
Very, very interesting. Thank you for illuminating me about British politics. Is that typically the way it works in parliamentary democracies?
Yes, it generally is. Yes, they choose.
So Angela Merkel is a Member of Parliament as well?
Yes.
Yeah. Fascinating.
And we should talk about Richard III at the end of the week.
Yeah, they dug him up.
Yes.
Amazing. Okay, we'll get into that tomorrow or the next day. Victoria Jones, thanks so much for being with us, Victoria.
Thank you.
Talk Radio News brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Check it out. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I want to get into this drone thing, but first I wanted to just share with you a blog post over on TomHartman.com. This is posted by Blue Horse, who I know, but I don't know if he wants me to out him, so I'm not going to say. But he writes, the basis of the so-called right-to-work legislation is that people can accept the benefits of a private club, in this case a union, without having to pay the dues required by that organization. He says, I think it might help to point out how ludicrous this notion is if the following steps were followed. One, find out what private clubs and other organizations the designers and implementers of these right-to-work-for-less bills frequent. Two, find out when they have special events, especially when there would be press coverage. Three, attend the events. Eat the food, drink the beverages and the other amenities available. Partake of this stuff. Four, when asked to leave, invoke your right to partake without paying dues. Legislation that the members have put into effect. 5. Remember the press, these clubs and organizations are incorporated. Remind them that since they are incorporated, they are persons under Citizens United. 7. Remind them that since it is illegal and unconstitutional to make laws that are biased against or in favor of specific groups or persons, it's obvious that these laws were meant for these clubs and organizations as well as unions. He says that the members and owners of the club or organization don't believe it and take action. It should make for a very interesting court case. Yeah, good one there. Good one there. Thank you, Blue Horse. Okay. Imagine that you're being stalked from the sky. Every time you go in or out of a building, it's recorded. Everybody you talk with, every place you drive or take public transportation, your sky stalker can see through your windows, can read your lips using infrared cameras, can even see if you've lit a cigarette and what type, if you know what I mean. Shouldn't this be illegal? When Larissa Olenek, the star of The Secret World of Alex Mack, found out that she had a stalker, she got a restraining order. But if her stalker had been the police and they were doing it with a drone, right now there'd be virtually no laws or regulations to protect her or you. Being concerned about such things is genuinely all American. I mean, you could literally say our private concern, it would be more of a truism to say our privacy concern started with George Orwell, who ironically was British, with the publication of his book 1984. But the reality, the literal reality, is that modern day American concern about government snooping into our lives goes back before the American Revolution. Thomas Jefferson, back before he was Secretary of State in the George Washington administration, before Washington was president, after the Revolutionary War, when we were operating under the Articles of Confederation and Jefferson was living in Paris, he was communicating in code ciphers, right? Code with his protege, James Madison, about their Federalist political enemies. Jefferson did it again when he became president in 1801, developing an even more elaborate code to communicate with his most trusted aide, Meriwether Lewis. Their concern, him and Meriwether Lewis, was which military officers, most of them leftovers from the John Adams administration, might be reading their mail. The president, thinking these guys might be reading, the military might be reading his mail, or interrogating White House servants. Hey, what's the president saying when you're around? Because these officers were actually thinking of pulling off a military coup to overthrow the Jefferson administration. Yes. So him and Meriwether Lewis are communicating in code. Lewis is like talking to all these members of the military secretly. And the result was that Jefferson, on Lewis's suggestion, fired 2/3 of all the commissioned officers in the military and cut the size of the army by over 80%. Fast forward to today. Police helicopters, police trucks that can use infrared to see inside your house, and GPS units cops can attach to your car. In every case, there is a legitimate police use for these technologies, as well as an incredible potential for abuse. Now, the Fourth Amendment, part of the Bill of Rights that Jefferson demanded Madison put into the Constitution as the price of getting Virginia's ratification, is one sentence long. It says, quote, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." End quote. In other words, they can't spy on you. On you personally, they can't spy on you unless they have enough proof to bring before a judge that you're up to something that's probably illegal. Now, in the case of the police helicopters, the trucks, the GPS units, phone taps, to some extent, both state governments, Congress, and the Supreme Court have brought their use at least into a marginal compliance with the Fourth Amendment. I mean, you know, it's not where I'd like it to be. It's probably not where you'd like it to be. There's big debates about it, but at least there is some law that regulates these things. Not so with drones, at least not yet. And that's why the city of Charlottesville, Virginia, you can stand in Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home. You can see Charlottesville down, you know, from on top of the hill. That's why Charlottesville did a beautiful thing this week in passing a resolution calling for a ban for the moment on information from drones in their skies. The Rutherford Institute proposed the first draft of what ultimately became the resolution that was promoted by the Charlottesville Center for Peace and Justice. It included language that said, whereas the federal government and the Commonwealth of Virginia have thus far failed to provide reasonable legal restrictions on the use of drones within the United States, and whereas police departments throughout the country have begun implementing drone technology absent any guidance or guidelines from lawmakers. That's the end of the quote from it. And then I'll paraphrase the rest because it's all in legalese. There should be at least a 2-year moratorium on using information obtained from drones or on weaponizing them. David Swanson points this out in his blog over at the CCPJ site. He says, quote, without proper safeguards, these drones, some of which are deceptively small and capable of videotaping the facial expressions of people on the ground from hundreds of feet in the air, will usher in a new age of surveillance in American society. Not even those indoors, in the privacy of their own homes, will be safe from these aerial spies, which can be equipped with technology capable of peering through walls. End a quote from David Swanson. And that doesn't even include the capability of these police drones to be weapon equipped, from bullets to nerve gas, or their ability to be hacked, or for their data streams to be hijacked by malicious corporations or weird stalkers or foreign governments. Now, the bottom line is nobody's saying, or very few people are saying, there's no legitimate place for drones in police work in America. They're a heck of a lot cheaper than that helicopter that famously followed O.J. Simpson's car, for example. At the most basic level, they're just an extension of already existing and already used technology. And yet, as with any technology, and I think email, for example, or text messages, you know, we've created legislation around, you know, that at some minimal level protects this stuff. We have to make sure that drones are used in a way that complies with the Fourth Amendment and respects our individual rights of privacy. And that's why it's way beyond time for us to be having a national conversation about drones over U.S. skies. And with the help of the CCPJ, Charlottesville has taken this great first step in starting that national dialogue. Oregon now has started a similar debate. In fact, both a Democrat and a Republican have introduced legislation to regulate drones and the data that comes from them to protect individual privacy rights. We all need to be working for solid legislative restrictions on police use of these drones. I'm not saying outlaw them. I mean, but there's a big difference between a police helicopter, you know, flying past your house and a drone, you know, filming you 24/7 for a week. Right? We need restrictions on the police use of these drones so that they can help legitimate police work while respecting the Fourth Amendment privacy rights of the rest of us. Sounds like a good idea?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And that's just, you know, of course, domestic drones here in the United States. I mean, you know, the whole issue of foreign drones and weaponized drones is a whole nother one. We'll talk about it after this. Welcome back. Occupying the Media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you and Todd in Bellingham, Washington. There's a Supreme Court decision that could apply to drones, really?
Yes, there is.
Tell me about it.
Well, it's called Kylo versus United States, or maybe it was U.S. versus Kylo. And they basically suspected this guy growing marijuana in his house, but they couldn't get enough probable cause for a warrant, so they got an infrared sensor.
Right, I remember the case.
Infrared sensor to look inside his house and see the heat lamps.
Right.
That he was using. Used that information to obtain a warrant.
Right.
Went in there, arrested him, and eventually his case made it to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, no, using a sensor to look into somebody's house is, you know, that's a protected search by the Fourth Amendment. You need
right.
a probable cause to do that. So absent a warrant, they can't use sensor information like that.
Right. So, okay, I don't disagree. That could be used. But, for example, if your house is subject to a stakeout, right now it requires 24-hour, you know, manpower, it requires police, you know, somebody in the in a patrol car, or at the very least put, you know, wireless cameras and trees and things. And for those kind of things, if they're going to just have people following you around, they actually don't need a warrant. If they're going to use technology, if they're going to put a wireless camera in a tree or they're going to tap your phones, they do need a warrant. If they use a drone, nobody knows.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that I was talking about.
Okay. Well, I was just talking about looking at that. You know, you're talking about being able to read your lips.
Yeah. You're right. I'm pretty sure that is
going to be a protected intrusion.
Yeah. Yeah. The infrared one. You're right. I'd forgotten about the Kilo case, or Kylo, however you say it. But you are right on that. Thank you. Thanks. I tell you, we got the smartest listeners on earth. Todd, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to 9:30 a.m. in Bellingham. Joe in Chevy Chase, Maryland. You want to tell me how wonderful libertarians are and how we have a totalitarian government?
Yeah, I know you always have a thing about us. It's a love-hate thing, right? It's like, this drone thing is another shining example of my continuing bafflement about why progressives who act like they stand up for civil rights support Obama so much. I mean,
well, hang on just a second, Joe. I just spent 20 minutes calling for the limitation of use of drones over the United States and serious laws and regulations, and you're telling me that I'm not?
No, I'm saying you are. You're taking a consistent stand, but I think it's funny the way the Democrats and most of the progressive crowd, they give them passes on all of this type of
stuff. I don't think that's true at all. I think the people, you know, David Swanson, the guy who got this legislation, you know, pushed through in Charlotte, Virginia, is one of the most solid progressive activists I know. Frankly, I think that this is an area, Joe, where progressives and libertarians should agree.
Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, I'm not for the Patriot Act. I think the Defense Authorization Act, which was an Obama thing, also got pushed through. And
actually, it was a congressional thing. The White House cannot originate legislation.
Did he sign it?
He signed it, yes, but he does not have the authority to originate legislation. He can't write legislation, and he does not have a line item veto. And if he hadn't signed it, because the Constitution says that military appropriations cannot last for more than 2 years, had he not signed it.
This is exactly what I'm talking about. You're making excuses for him. You know, I vote libertarian. Yeah, you can say you can throw your vote away, but, you know, if the progressives interpreted the Fourth Amendment or the Second Amendment like they interpret the Fourth Amendment, we'd all be allowed to have nuclear weapons, and I don't want that either. But it's things that drive us libertarians crazy about you guys is that you're very selective, and if somebody has the right, quote, correct views on whether it's gay marriage or abortion or whatever, they get a pass on everything else. I mean, you know, my God, you know.
I think you're missing something very fundamental here, Joe. First of all, you're wrong about my take on the Second Amendment, and I think, frankly, most progressives. But beyond, that's another argument for another time. You're suggesting is that libertarians, correct me if I'm wrong, is that libertarians have a consistent philosophical view, and because it's consistent, which is basically that other than the army and the court system to enforce fraud laws and the police department, basically there's no other function for government, and that everything from our schools to our roads should be private, and Social Security and everything else, it's all unconstitutional. It should all be privatized and run on a profit basis. Because you have that consistent thread through your thinking, any issue can be brought into that, and you'll have a consistent opinion. Whereas you're suggesting that liberals and progressives have no consistent thinking and no consistent philosophical thread, and therefore are picking and choosing what they like and don't like. Am I paraphrasing or accurately conveying what you're trying to say?
I think you're accurately paraphrasing the.
Okay, then let me give you.
Not libertarians, but the liberals, yes. I mean, and I'm not. Look, I'm what I'm called a beyond a reasonable doubt libertarian, right? I think in order to have government action, you should have almost the same standard that's applied in a criminal case in court that says before we're going to impose restrictions on people, it should be beyond a reasonable doubt type level of surety.
Sure.
And then fine.
I understand. And frankly, the Libertarian Party would disagree with you on that, but the Cato Institute would too. But let me tell you, liberals, I encourage you to study liberal philosophy, starting with arguably the founders of the modern Enlightenment, you know, John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and Thomas Jefferson. And what you will find is that there is a core of liberal philosophy, and that core is that there is this thing called the commons. And the commons is the stuff that we collectively must provide to each other, because while some of us can get it for ourselves, a few people can get health care, for example, a few people can get education for themselves, all of us don't have access to it, and therefore there is not a universal right to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, unless the commons is protected. And liberals do not want the commons to be privatized. And the debate within liberal circles is, where does the commons begin and end? You know, is our college system part of the commons? I think it is. Others don't. You know, right up until recently, everybody thought that our primary schools were part of the commons. But still, there is, that's the core of liberal thinking.
It hinges on whether you can figure out the externalities, and that's a whole other...
Well, yeah, that's a whole other conversation, and that's where I think libertarians fall apart, is because, you know, you're not defining the externalities of corporate activity. But Joe will have to live to fight that battle again some other time, too, because we're out of time. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But I still think that we need some reasonable restrictions on drones, and we need them damn quick. There's already several hundred of them in the air, and 30,000 permits have been authorized. Parvacentiously ugly, the good. Brendan Ian Badejo. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. He's a fairly famous linebacker, but I'm not a sports fan, so I don't know. Anyhow, he's a linebacker with the Super Bowl-winning Baltimore Ravens, and he promised that if he won the Super Bowl, he would use the fame that came with it to speak out for LGBT equality. And on Monday, he did just that. Check it out.
Everyone's been talking to gay people our entire lives, whether we know it or not, but we really believe that you're born gay, and I've had plenty of conversations with people that are gay, and they say they're born gay, no different than me being born this beautiful almond coconut color that I am. People are born gay, so why treat them any differently? It's time that we treat everybody fairly, and not only are we trying to dictate who people should love, we're also trying to dictate who people should be. If a woman wants to wear man's clothes, or if a man wants to wear women's clothes, or you feel like you're a woman on the inside and you're really a man, who cares? Let's just treat everybody equally. Let's move on. Let's evolve as a culture, as a people.
Well done, Brendan. Couldn't have said it better myself. The bad. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of Wall Street, Big Bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, said in a speech in Miami yesterday that the United States lacks the will to enact the austerity policies that have devastated much of Europe. Dimon said, quote, "Well, what I'll say about Europe is that they have the will. Listen to their politicians. Their politicians say there is no plan B. The euro will not be dissolved. The way is very complicated and will take many years. The United States is the opposite. We know exactly the way. It's something called like a Simpson Bowles. We've seen a lot of different plans come out. We don't yet have the will. The United States is a far simpler problem." End of quote. Well, Jamie, you're a little off. Thanks to austerity, Republicans in Congress have forced our government to make huge budget cuts that are already wreaking havoc on our economy and society, and the same thing has happened in Europe. It's time for the American people to say no to austerity so that we don't become the next Greece. And the very, very ugly, Abdullah Daoud. Daoud, a Saudi cleric, told an Islamic television station the baby girls should be veiled to avoid sexual harassment. Daoud said that girls should wear the veil from the age of 2. He went on to say that if a girl is sexually desired, her parents should cover her face and force her to wear a veil to protect her from sexual deviance. As you can imagine, the comments have sparked outrage in Saudi Arabia and across the globe. Some of Daoud's fellow Saudi clerics have publicly denounced the comments as well. But the fact is, Daoud would rather cover up little baby girls than throw the sexual deviants who go after them in jail. And that is very, very ugly. Yeah. There you go. Surfer John in Ben Lomond, California. Spines not in the Constitution?
Hey, Tom.
Hey. Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was briefly distracted. Hey, Tom, I want to thank you for bringing up this topic. You know, the drones are terrifying. Just the notion that you can, you know, we become so powerful, our nation, that we really need to do a double check on who we are before we wield that kind of power. In this nation, we should be able to address the problem. And I'm glad I wanted to thank you for touching on, because people say, oh, well, you know, the right to privacy is vague. And not, you know,
there's, I think it's
not
vague at all.
As far as privacy, but the rules around arresting somebody are quite clear. And as you stated, the rules around spying on somebody in order to obtain information that will lead to their eventual arrest are quite clear.
Yeah.
And they're quite clearly being ignored. So I think sometimes it's just a matter of the right group of lawyers, Tom.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the right group of Americans, Surfer John. We've got to get, we've got to build a parade. We've got to get enough Americans to actually read that one sentence that's the Fourth Amendment, because it's written in very plain language and anybody can read it and go, oh, I get it. You know, why are we doing so much of this stuff? Surfer John, thanks a lot for the call. Howard in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Howard, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I have a little different twist on this drone situation.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that Al-Qaeda suddenly had available to them an unlimited number of drones.
Right.
And they moved into Mexico and Canada and electronically scrambled their area so they couldn't be found. And they start targeting Obama administration people. I'm wondering where this conversation will go, considering that as a possibility.
I don't think you need to even get that inflammatory. I mean, what if Mexico, which certainly has the means to have drones, drones are cheap now, you know, compared to other kinds of technology. What if Mexico simply decided to acquire a small army of drones and start using them over the southwestern United States to track their very own drug traffickers and gun runners that they would like to put a stop to, and legitimately would like to put a stop to? You know, do you really think the good citizens of Arizona and New Mexico and Southern California are going to put up with that?
Well, not well, when the first school bus is hit.
Well, you're talking armed drones, right? And that's the metaphor that I use, where you know, it's like we know. I'm just waiting to find out what the blowback is, and we'll probably know in the next decade or so. But we know that back in the late 80s, actually early 90s, when George Herbert Walker Bush invaded Kuwait to drive out Saddam Hussein, he built an Air Force base in Saudi Arabia as a staging point. And that so infuriated Osama bin Laden that the holy land, you know, defined in the Quran of his country, Saudi Arabia, where, you know, had a place on it where men were drinking alcohol and women were driving cars and showing their elbows, that, you know, he basically in 1998 put us on notice that if we didn't close that Air Force base and get the hell off the holy land of Saudi Arabia, that he was going to take us out. He was going to attack us. And he attacked us a whole bunch of times. Each time the demand was the same. Get the Air Force base out of Saudi Arabia. Now, George W. Bush did that in 2006 or 2007 after 9/11. But, you know, it took a while. But you could say that the blowback for the first Gulf War was 9/11. And I'm just wondering, you know, we're using drones right now and we're blowing up, you know, families and children and all kinds of things in the Middle East and in countries that we're not at war with, in Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia. And at what point, you know, when is that blowback going to occur? You know, I don't know the answer, but I certainly know the question.
Point,
go ahead.
If I may bring it up, shock and awe.
Oh, yeah.
What was that all about?
Yeah.
When Obama was able to take care of Gaddafi with what? An airstrike? One airstrike without destroying the whole infrastructure of a company so Halliburton could be hired to rebuild it?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that was, I think the whole shock and awe thing was the Bush administration just being so impressed by their own, you know, hey, let's have a fireworks show. You know, George wanted to be Franklin Roosevelt. He wanted to be a wartime president, you know, major war, serious stuff. You know, in 1999, he told Mickey Herskowitz in fact, we've got Cindy Sheehan with the clip of it. He told his biographer, Mickey Herskowitz, who is a longtime family friend who was hired to ghostwrite George Bush's autobiography, A Charge to Keep, and ultimately wrote the first draft, and then it wasn't fawning enough, and so they hired somebody else to write the second draft. But in those 100 or so hours of video or audio taped conversations between Herskowitz and George Bush, which Herskowitz later published parts of it, and was picked up, Here's Cindy Sheehan testifying under oath before Congress, quoting a clip from Herskowitz. Here she is.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
And his and what he wanted to get passed, and then Cindy goes on to say, it looks like my son's fate was sealed even before he joined the military in 2001. And because this was in 1999 that George Bush was talking about this. And, of course, in 1998, Jeb Bush's brother had signed the PNAC document calling on Clinton to invade Iraq. So, I think that that's what that was all about, is George Bush wanted to have his little hoop-de-doo. Howard, thanks a lot for the call. Brian in McCungie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Brian, got a minute to the break. What's up?
Hey, Tom, I just want to mention something about the right-to-work issue.
Mm-hmm.
We live in Pennsylvania, where we have a Republican-majority legislature and governor, and they are trying to introduce that legislature to for us to be a right-to-work state.
Right. Right-to-work for less.
How that? I'm sorry?
Right-to-work for less.
Absolutely. My wife's a school teacher. She's a union member. And where the split is there is you could be a full union member, as she is, or you can pay what they call a fair share, which allows the union to negotiate salaries, but you get no representation when there's an issue with your performance or if you're being targeted by administration wrongfully.
Right.
You know, that type of situation.
Yeah.
You get no representation.
Yeah. I'm with Steve, who says, you know, we ought to go to the clubs, the country clubs owned by these fat cats with the ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that's putting these laws together, and say, you know, yeah, I'll have some of those hors d'oeuvres, I'll have a glass of that champagne. No, I'm not a member, I don't pay dues, but hey, I should get the benefits anyway. Brian, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour, David wants to tell us drone strikes are completely justified. We'll get to that in about 4 minutes. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. And David in Ontario, Canada, wants to tell us that drone strikes are completely justified. Really? David? David, are you there? Oh, David's not there. Okay, well, we tried. Steve in Manhattan, New York, listening to WWRL. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you? Yes, I have such an interesting thing. Also, I saw a screener, you've seen a screen about the ethics of the medical industry.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was in the Guardian, UK Guardian, 2004, April 4, 2004, that they gave orphans AIDS medication as for experiments. Some of them may have died. And they tested AIDS medication on orphans in New York City. Also, there's another program in New York City that was called the CHEERS program, Children's Environmental Exposure Research Study.
Right.
They gave poor African Americans, Latino children, and disabled children, and poor lower income children pesticides, chemicals, and see what would happen, and to test it on these children. And so,
Go back to the Tuskegee experiments, you know.
The Tuskegee experiment was 1932 to 1972,
right.
And then it gets and also another experiment, and also the in Guatemala,
yeah,
from 1946 to 1948, which Hillary Clinton actually apologized for.
Well, and let's look at the giant GMO experiment that we're all participating in right now.
Right. Also, Willowbrook, I think, school in Staten Island.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually exposed by Robert Kennedy, and also Geraldo Rivera did a piece in the 70s on it, and it was they did horrible things to those children. They gave the delivery and infect those children with hepatitis A, and to see what the experiments, and it was like horrible things were done, it was basically a snake pit.
Yeah.
And
So what's your point, Steve?
My point is basically I mean, also is another experiment.
Is your point that Big Pharma was doing all these things, or that big government is nasty, or
well, it's big government, big pharma together? They have this, they have these horrible programs, and they do it. They oppress the poor and the minorities, and
yeah.
horrible experiments. They probably still do it. And in South Carolina, the woman was sterilized.
Sure.
And she was in 1974, I believe, she was raped by some guy. So there was this eugenics board decided in 1970, 60-something, I think,
mm-hmm.
they'd sterilized her, and it was ABC News story.
Yeah.
ABC News.
Steve, I think that all of this argues for more transparency. I don't disagree with you. And Big Pharma has really, in some cases, gone off the rails, as has our government. I mean, we just need to acknowledge these things. The fact that you and I know about it and can talk about it on the radio, though, I think is a really important step in the direction of waking Americans up to this. David in Ontario, you want to try this drone strike conversation again?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Sorry, I accidentally hit the mute button when you had come on.
So okay,
sorry
no problem.
About that. But I was here the whole time.
Okay, so
yeah, actually, I do think that the drone strikes are justified, and it's preferable, obviously, to the full invasion of a country with landed troops. And mm-hmm. I think actually that the drone strike should have been done with very limited troops on the ground from the very beginning in Afghanistan. Of course, I don't think that Iraq was correct. I think they should have gone into Iran instead of Iraq.
Let me ask you a question, David. If Canada sent a drone over Phoenix because they found a major, I'm sorry, not Canada, Mexico. If Mexico sent a drone over Phoenix because they found a major Mexican drug lord was living in a neighborhood in Phoenix and took out his house and maybe killed a few civilians in the nearby houses, would you have a problem with that?
I would only have a problem with that if the drug lord in at first, okay, so the drug lord had absolutely no plans and had not in the past had any attacks been carried out by this individual upon United States soil. Okay.
So you're suggesting that a country should have the right to invade the sovereign territory of another country and kill citizens of that country or citizens, any citizen of, including, you know, of any country.
Yes.
If it decides that those people have broken the law, do you think that there should at least be a trial before this death sentence is delivered?
No, because if people are harboring known terrorists and known organizations that are...
How are they known if there's not a trial?
To make terror.
Who makes that determination if not a judge and jury?
The intelligence community does.
So you're willing to surrender to the intelligence community all that power?
Hang on. Hold on. You can preempt the war, okay? You can preempt the war without waiting to be attacked.
I don't disagree with you, but why not at least have due process before you do it? It might only take a day or two extra.
What due process were the Americans of 9/11 given? What trial were the people that?
So you're saying that because brutality was visited upon us, we should be brutal toward others. Because lawlessness was visited on us, we should become like Osama bin Laden and be lawless ourselves. That's what you just said. You said, where was the due process for the victims of 9/11? Obviously, there was none.
I didn't use those words. I didn't use those terms.
You just said. You said, where was the due process for the victims of 9/11?
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that these people are not out to give due process to Americans, and I'm not saying that Americans shouldn't give due process in return. But you cannot.
But you just said they should not get due process.
You can't treat the enemy better than the enemy is going to be treating you. If a sheep goes up to a lion, what's the lion going to do to the sheep?
So when George Washington made the order,
you have to treat the lion that way.
When George Washington made the order to his troops that when they took British prisoners of war, they should treat them well, which was the exact opposite of what the British did. They routinely murdered American prisoners of war. You think George Washington was wrong?
No, I think prisoners of war should be treated with human dignity and respect, absolutely. That's not what I'm suggesting.
All right, David, we'll leave it on that. We've run out of time. Thanks for the call. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, we'll have the latest on America's gun control debate and what's happening in Congress. Plus, how cool would it be if we all had free Wi-Fi in all our major cities and much of the rural parts of the country? Couldn't it be part of our commons? We'll find out why conservatives disagree and the best of the rest of the news, along with your calls, right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.